using an overpriced trash bag.
Pricey, pricey, pricey!
A bag that breaks.
Whippy, whippy, whippy!
Or a smelly bag.
Stinky, stinky, stinky!
Time to switch to Hefty Ultra Strong Trash Bags, always at an ultra low price.
Hefty, hefty, hefty!
They're our best bags yet, and they cost less than Glad Force Flex were sold head to head. So you'll be
happy, happy, happy!
Hefty Ultra Strong with Arm & Hammer Odor Control. Available at Sam's Club.
Hefty, hefty, hefty!
Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome. You're listening to the Change Agent's Dilemma for Tuesday, November 18th, 2014. I'm your host, Heather Stegel, coming to you live from Atlanta, Georgia, as I do once a month on Blog Talk Radio. This show is one of the many ways I help equip individuals and teams to influence change at Enclaria. The Change Agent's Dilemma is how to influence change without authority, and my goal with this show is to share ideas to help you do just that. Today, my guest is Dr. Roger Dean Duncan, who is here to share insights from his book, Change-Friendly Leadership. After an early career as an award-winning journalist and university professor, Roger Dean Duncan founded Duncan Worldwide in 1972 to serve the needs of organizations seeking to boost performance. A highly sought-after speaker, trainer, and executive coach, Roger is widely known for his expertise in the strategic management of change for individuals as well as for organizations. He keynotes many industry conferences and workshops related to human performance and organizational effectiveness. In addition to his consulting practice, Roger headed worldwide communication for Campbell Soup Company and was vice president of a global energy company. He's also served on the faculties of three major universities. Roger earned a PhD in Communication and Organizational Dynamics at Purdue University. The Duncan Report, his blog on leadership and organizational effectiveness, now reaches subscribers in more than 150 countries. Roger is also a frequent contributor to Fast Company and Forbes magazines. Roger, welcome to the show.
Great to be with you, Heather. Thank you.
Thank you. So we're here to talk about your book, Change-Friendly Leadership. So what motivated you to write this book?
I guess I was motivated to write it for many years. People ask me, how long did it take you to write the book? And I say, well, there are two answers, 40 years or 5 months. It took me about 5 months to sit down and actually write the book. But early in my career, very early in my career, I was a journalist, and one of my editors was Jim Lehrer. Most people know him from his many years on PBS. Mm-hmm. And Jim told me, and I covered politics and business. Jim told me one day that the key to a good story was to examine the gap between people's good intentions and what they actually produced, whether they're political figures or business people or anybody. And I took that to heart. I've watched very carefully over the years a lot of people in a lot of different arenas who have very good intentions, and some of them bring those intentions to fruition, and many of them don't. And that has motivated me over the years to examine very carefully what are the constraints, what are the common denominators of success. And as you mentioned, I've been a consultant since 1972 and have observed a lot of leaders in a lot of different situations, ranging from working with people in two White House administrations to senior executives of organizations in every industry you can imagine, all the way down to the shop floor. So it really doesn't matter at what level you're working. The same principles apply. And a lot of this is really about engagement. We hear a lot about engagement, and I think that's a really critical element of a high-performing organization. The Gallup organization, as you probably know, does a lot of research around engagement, ongoing research. They do surveys in tens of thousands of organizations, and they track the data. And the Gallup people have found that overall about 30% of people in most organizations are what they call inspired and engaged. The language I use is they have a sense of psychological ownership of their work, but not a sense of entitlement at all, but they own the work. They own the opportunity to succeed. they feel a part of the organization. Gallup says about 52% of people in most organizations are present but not engaged. And I tell my clients that the second most expensive thing that can happen in your organization is when your best and brightest people quit and leave. That's very expensive. But the most expensive thing is when your best and brightest people quit and stay. They show up every day, but they're really not engaged. That's very expensive. And then Gallup says that typically about 18% of people are actively disengaged. They're just sort of checked out. And they say that their research shows that this disengagement costs business just in the U.S. about $550 billion a year in lost productivity. So change-friendly leadership is all about engagement. It's all about creating an environment where people have that sense of psychological ownership. It's all about trust and talking openly and all of those kinds of skills that I'm sure we'll talk about. So that's what motivated me early on to explore over about 40 years. I sort of did 40 years of social science research as I was working in all these organizations, and then I just decided to write the book.
Great. So you have this concept called the four T's of leadership, of change-friendly leadership. So tell us about what those are.
Well, the four T's are about behaviors. Many years ago, I wrote an article for a national magazine. They asked me to explore the views of famous people on a single question. What's the mark of an educated person? And I interviewed everybody from Margaret Mead to Norman Rockwell to people in academia, politics, business, and asked them only that one question. What's the mark of an educated person? And I was fascinated that in all of those interviews, not a single person mentioned a university or a college degree. Most of them didn't even talk about time in the classroom. They talked about specific behaviors. And I found that interesting, and I have found that whole paradigm interesting over the last 40-plus years as I've worked with leaders at every level in many kinds of organizations, that the ones who are most effective are so, certainly not because of title, and I love that you talk about influence versus authority. It's all about specific behaviors. And so over the years, I have observed very carefully, and I've made an inventory of the behaviors that are consistently associated with high performance. And I've distilled those into what I call the four T's. And the four T's are think friendly, talk friendly, trust friendly, and team friendly. Think friendly behaviors include adopting a growth mindset that you are capable of solving problems in fresh ways. It includes exercising curiosity by asking smart questions to explore and discover. And it includes challenging your own conclusions. The really capable, smart, high productive people that I've observed over the years are very good at challenging their own conclusions. And by the way, they're not at all offended when somebody else challenges their conclusions. You mentioned that I was an executive at Campbell Soup Company many years ago, and one of the CEOs I worked with was a man named Gordon McGovern, a very bright, Harvard-educated, very capable guy. What made him most effective was not his formal education, but the way he interacted with other people. And I recall many times when he had made it safe for people at every level to challenge him on things, and he wasn't threatened by that at all. I remember one time a young intern challenged Gordon's view on a particular product development kind of thing, and rather than be threatened by it or rather than try to impose his authority or will on this young intern. Gordon said, "That's terrific. You see it differently. Help me understand how you came to that conclusion." And he wasn't playing gotcha. He really wanted to know. He respected the other person. And so that's one of these talk-friendly behaviors and think-friendly behaviors. Talk-friendly is about, you know, collaborative dialogue, appreciative inquiry, and all that. And then trust-friendly is about creating an environment where people don't feel threatened. You aren't pulling rank. You aren't playing favorites. You aren't asking people to do fake work. That's all about trust. And then the team-friendly skills are about creating an environment where people who work in teams, and in most organizations, you work on numerous teams. And I talk about very specific characteristics of effective teams. You know, they need to have a compelling purpose, and I think virtually every team needs to have a written team charter. And it's not very complicated, but in the absence of a team charter that outlines the purpose of the team and the authority of the team and the parameters of the challenges facing the team and the resources available to the team, et cetera, without committing that to writing, a lot of dangerous ambiguity can enter the picture. So that's what the four T's are. The four T's are sort of the hub of the wheel of the change-friendly framework that I've set up, that I've used for about 40 years in every kind of environment you can think of, and it works.
Great. Well, let's dig a little deeper into one of these. Can you tell us about how talk-friendly behaviors help facilitate effective change?
Sure. Talk-friendly behaviors are, well, look at it this way. As I mentioned when I was talking about Gordon McGovern, he was especially effective, not by virtue of his formal education, but by virtue of the way he interacted with other human beings. And you can say that about any of us. We don't add our greatest value because we're good with a spreadsheet or flipping switches or something like that. We add our greatest value by virtue of how we interact with other human beings, and most of that, even in this age of computers and Twitter and email and all that, most of that is interacting in conversation. How do we talk with people? Are we talk friendly? The terminology I use, and this includes acknowledging undiscussables. There are, in most organizations, undiscussables. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it may be somebody's style. It may be, some I call them, and everybody calls them, either sacred cows or the elephant on the table. I use the elephant on the table metaphor. And we need to be skilled at identifying those elephants, challenging the elephants. Another talk-friendly skill is to relinquish power. I mentioned, again, Gordon McGovern, and I've worked with a lot of people who are really good at that. They have the title. They have the corner office. They have the special parking place and all that. But in interacting with people, they don't pull rank. They make it safe to be challenged. And that is enormously important for people around you to feel safe in challenging your viewpoint. Another talk-friendly skill is to defer judgment. Don't jump to a conclusion too quickly. Listen with empathy is important. And now, empathy is about understanding. Sympathy is about agreement. You may not agree with everybody on your team, and that's, frankly, that's perfectly okay, because if everybody agrees on everything, you probably have the wrong people on the team. It's perfectly okay to disagree. Just disagree civilly and strategically and put your viewpoints on the table and discuss them openly, come to a conclusion as a group, and then move on in a united way. But you know, wait for people to put their viewpoint out and listen with empathy, with the purpose not necessarily of agreeing, but of understanding. And if they feel that you're truly interested in understanding, they're much more likely to put their smarts on the table. And then another talk-friendly skill is to inquire to discover. Ask questions not to play gotcha. And yeah. Most of us have seen people who love to play that game. They'll keep asking challenging questions, and they seem like smart questions. And they don't seem satisfied until they ask a question for which you have no answer. And then they kind of lean back in the chair, and it's like, okay, I'm the smartest guy in the room, and I want you all to know it. Well, I tell folks that if you are consistently the smartest guy in the room, you're in the wrong room. You need to surround yourself with people who not only are smart, but who are not intimidated to use their smarts. And that comes about when you practice these 4T skills well. So, and then a final one or another one would be to advocate with respect. We're all going to have views that we advocate, but rather than trying to ram our viewpoint down somebody's throat, it's best to respectfully offer illustrations, offer data, offer facts, to, you know, demonstrate to them that, at least in our view, our perspective, our idea has merit. And then, of course, invite them honestly to challenge our viewpoints. It's really a joy to see people sitting around the table practicing these talk-friendly skills. And what you have then is smart people helping each other be smarter. And that's a wonderful thing in an organization.
Well, and it seems like the underpinning of all this is humility and respect seems to be throughout all these.
Pretty basic stuff, yeah.
Well, if you could pick the single most powerful tool in the leader's toolkit for increasing people's openness to change, what would it be?
I would say listening is so critical, and managing resistance. With change, one of the reasons that change efforts frequently fail, in fact, one of the biggest reasons, is that folks try to practice change by announcement. They just make an announcement, and it's just like the king says, "Let it be so." Well, we know that doesn't work. And yet people try it all the time. We see it constantly. It just doesn't work. And so I would say listening is a really critical skill, and managing resistance. Let me just say a couple of things about resistance. Here's kind of a to-do list on resistance. Double-check your assumptions about resistance. Learn to regard resistance as an opportunity to clarify your message, to fine-tune your approach, and even course-correct your direction. Some of the best ideas you can have, you can get, will come from people who disagree with you. So if you've created an environment where it's not safe to resist, you're missing an opportunity to learn some things. That can be a wonderful early warning system that what you're proposing is going to hit some road bumps. Another one would be to use resistance as a springboard to dialogue, not as an evil enemy to be clubbed into submission. But like I mentioned earlier, I've seen really effective people say things like, "Terrific, you disagree. Help me understand your perspective." And when they feel honored and respected in that way, then they are much more likely, one, to help you understand some of the flaws in your own reasoning, and they are much more likely to get on board with the change when they feel that they've been appropriately ignored. Also, pinpoint the source of the resistance. Ask yourself, is the resistance about the what or the how of your change? Is the person resisting unhappy about losing the old, you know, position, opportunity, et cetera, or apprehensive about the meaning of the new. And then listen more and talk less. You know, engage people in conversations about their work. Ask them questions that prime the pump for dialogue. Ask them things like, what gets in your way? What makes your work really fulfilling? What concerns do you have? What could make things better for you? Now, at this point, you're not really in the judging mode. You're in the gathering mode. So this listening with empathy really, really pays big dividends.
Sure. Well, and if we don't have these conversations, people will still resist. It'll just be harder to find.
Well, yes. You know, as you well know, being an expert on change, change comes in several flavors, and the two most common are covert and overt. And I would much rather have resistance out in the open where we can discuss it and deal with it and benefit from it than to make the resistors feel that they are, you know, unwelcome interlopers and they're going to get into
trouble.
Right, not to the old cliches. Well, he's not a team player. Well,
right.
Think about it. If you are advocating a change, what are you doing? You are resisting the status quo. So resistance is the resistance is not in and of itself a negative thing. So
right.
Resistance is most, when you really peel off all the layers, resistance typically is about somebody disagreeing with your resistance.
Right. So. Okay, well, what is the least change-friendly thing you see leaders doing?
Well, I think I mentioned it earlier, change by announcement and failing to engage the heads, hearts, and hopes of people. So many so-called leaders, and often they're leaders by title rather than by behavior, they use the old, try to use the old command and control kind of thing. Now, you know, they would say that they're not doing that, but their behavior would say that they are doing that. They're very big on compliance and not all that big on commitment. I think both are important. I was one time at a nuclear power station talking with a senior officer about performance issues, and we were talking about safety issues. And, of course, that's really critical at a nuclear power station. And he said basically, you know, I don't really care if people are committed here. I just want them to comply. You know, we have all these regulations, all of these procedures. I just want them to do what they're told, you know, just move on. And I kept trying to get him to understand that I thought that was important, of course, but commitment was important too. And he wasn't getting it. So I noticed behind his desk some family photos. And I said, are those your little boys? He said, yeah. And I asked him about his sons. And so suddenly he slips into the dad mode rather than the engineering mode. And I said, tell me about them. And he said, well, you know, this boy is 5 and this boy is 7 and we have so much fun. And I said, oh, boy, I bet you do. Children are fun. And I said, by the way, do you have seatbelt laws in your state? He said, oh, yeah, yeah. I said, do your boys use seatbelts in the car? He said, oh, yeah, we have an SUV, and I bought the very best car seats you can get, and we go through this little routine like we're pretending that they are astronauts and, you know, check, check, check as I strap them in. And I said, well, that sounds like fun. I said, I guess you do that because you don't want to be pulled over by a state trooper and given a citation. He said, that never occurred to me. I said, well, why do you go to all that trouble? He said, well, because I love my boys. I said, well, that would be commitment. You know, you are committed to their safety. It's not about the regulations. It's about the purpose of the regulation. I said, that's commitment. Well, I think a lot of leaders make the mistake of just one. I mean, they say all the nice stuff, but in their hearts they don't really care that much about the commitment. They just want people to do what they're told. And if that is in your heart of hearts, your primary orientation, it will show. So I think that's a common mistake.
Okay, so the people who listen to this show are primarily people who are leading change from the middle of their organizations. And so, we're talking about leaders which tends to have this connotation of people who have authority in the organization. So they're probably listening and thinking, yeah, I wish other people would do that. So I'm curious, you know, how can someone who's in that kind of a role help leaders become more change friendly?
I think change agents are a very important key in change. And as you say, change agents are often the people who are who have been given the responsibility to, quote, make it happen. And yet they are not necessarily the key sponsors of the change. They might not be designated as the, quote, leaders. So that's a challenge. So here's what I recommend. When you are in that role and you are working at the behest of a leader above you in the organization, and let's call that leader a sponsor, the quality of sponsorship you get is absolutely critical to the success of the change. And I suggest you delete from your vocabulary the word support, because the word support is so often misused. Well, I need your support. No, you need more than support. First, let's look at the two major kinds of sponsors. You have the authorizing sponsor. That's somebody who provides the budget, gets it on the agenda, makes the announcement, and all that sort of stuff. You also need a cascading of reinforcing sponsors. Otherwise, you'll have what often happens is sort of a black hole in the middle of the organization where the change effort dies. So you need that those reinforcing sponsors. Now, in terms of your relationship with your key sponsor, you need to manage up. And I have found that the best way to do that is to sit down with the sponsor and contract with the sponsor. And the language pattern could be something like, I know you are really committed to the success of this initiative, and here are some things that we're doing. Give a brief report and say, here is specifically what we need from you. We're having an all-hands meeting on Thursday. Here's a 3x5 card with 4 bullet points that I would like for you to cover in your discussion with our employees. Something that specific. And in some cases, in most cases, I recommend you put that contract in writing. And it's not a legal document, no. It's just a confirming document. You know, we met last week and we talked about this. Here's what you agreed to do, bang, 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 bang. I have never met a sponsor yet who did not appreciate that level of clarity, because you're helping them understand specifically what they can do to help you and others succeed with something that they have advocated. So why would they resist that?
So, well, and how do you link the 4 T's into something like that?
Well, you practice the 4 T's. In fact, you practice them yourself, and then you coach the leader on very specific things that the leader could do. You could say, for example, at the all-hands meeting, we're going to be talking about this. There's a pretty good chance that somebody's going to have some question. In fact, if somebody, for whatever reason, maybe the ghosts of all-hands meetings past, if people don't feel comfortable in broaching a question, maybe a challenging question, that you suspect are really is a question that really is on the minds of some people, if they don't ask it, you pose it, sponsor. You say, some of you may be wondering if, some of you may be wondering why. And then put the question out there. I mean, a question that they might think would be really uncomfortable. Lay it out there. Show them that it's okay to talk about this. In fact, it's critical that we talk about it. And then answer the question. And, you know, you do that with 2 or 3 of those kinds of questions, and people will get the idea that, okay, I guess it really is safe to talk about this. So, you know, engage the sponsor in conversation about how the sponsor can practice the 4T behaviors. And then, of course, you need to practice them yourself. You know, you're modeling them for the sponsor and everybody around you. And one of the important things about leadership, I think, is not to create a bunch of followers, but to create more leaders. because with that cascading effect, you need leadership throughout the organization. You know, somebody from the boardroom can make an announcement and, you know, sort of a change by announcement situation. It can get totally lost unless and until people at the worker level have that reinforcement from their own leaders. So that's what I mean by cascading sponsorship. And this idea of contracting with sponsors is really, really powerful to help bring that about.
Great advice. Well, Roger, thank you so much for being here. And Roger's book is called Change Friendly Leadership. I recommend it. You can learn a lot more detail, and he even has a 7-step change framework involved in there too. So thanks again for being here.
Thanks much.
And coming up next month on Tuesday, December 16th, Deborah McLaughlin shares how to ignite your communication style to gain influence and impact. Thank you for listening to the Change Agent's Dilemma. If you'd like to find more resources to help you influence change in your organization, including individual coaching, team workshops, and upcoming training events, please visit enclaria.com. While you're there, sign up for my monthly newsletter and receive 12 free templates from my change management toolkit, the Irresistible Change Guide. Until next time, take care and best wishes for your change initiative.
Using an overpriced trash bag.
Pricey, pricey, pricey!
A bag that breaks.
Whippy, whippy, whippy!
Or a smelly bag.
Stinky, stinky, stinky!
Time to switch to Hefty Ultra Strong trash bags, always at an ultra low price.
Hefty, hefty, hefty!
They're our best bags yet, and they cost less than Glad ForceFlex were sold head-to-head. So you'll be...
happy, happy, happy!
Hefty Ultra Strong with Arm & Hammer Odor Control. Available at Sam's Club.
Hefty, hefty, hefty!
Using an overpriced trash bag.
Pricey, pricey, pricey!
A bag that breaks.
Whippy, whippy, whippy!
Or a smelly bag.
Stinky, stinky, stinky!
Time to switch to Hefty Ultra Strong trash bags, always at an ultra low price.
Hefty, hefty, hefty!
They're our best bags yet, and they cost less than Glad ForceFlex were sold head-to-head. So you'll be...
happy, happy, happy!
Hefty Ultra Strong with Arm & Hammer Odor Control. Available at Sam's Club.
Hefty, hefty, hefty! Dude.